From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts Democrats debate the future of the minority party in the U.S. House of Representatives and who should lead them.
We've got to listen to the American people. We've got to develop a new strategy moving forward. We've got to have a serious plan for the future.
Let's have that debate. Let's have a race. Let's have people challenge with ideas. My support, now that we know who the candidates are, remains with Nancy Pelosi.
Also today, last week's election in Massachusetts showed how a blue state is becoming a little more red. Plus, musical expressions of Islam from the Boston-based Turkish composer Mehmet Ali Sanlıkal and his concerns about Muslim stereotypes in the time of Trump. All that coming up this hour on Radio Boston. First, this news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. And we'll begin today with Massachusetts Democrats in Washington and reaction to President-elect Donald Trump's first moves as he begins to fill out his administration. Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions for Attorney General, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn for National Security Advisor, and Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo to head the CIA. All Trump loyalists, all deeply conservative. Earlier today, we spoke to Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark about how the Trump administration is taking shape and what it portends for the future.
I think that what we are seeing is a continuation of people who were on the campaign and supportive. My real concern so far coming out of the transition, however, is the appointment of Steve Bannon as chief strategist. He is a person who is known for the propaganda he put forth at Breitbart. That included many anti-Semitic, racist, misogynist articles and conspiracy theories. And having him now set up to whisper in the president's ear is of grave concern, and I think it should be to all Americans.
What can Democrats like you really do about this, though? Because, of course, as White House counselor, he's not subjected to any kind of congressional approval process, either by the Senate or the House. So, I mean, what in effect can you really do?
I think the role that we have is to draw attention to who these people are, what they stand for, and to continue to hold President-elect Trump to the pledge that he made. He said he would now be a president for all Americans, and that's the pledge that I'm going to hold him to. And when he puts someone who has espoused racist, anti-Semitic, misogynist views, that is not living up to that pledge. And I think it is up to us to call him out, to make sure that the public knows and is informed of the background of the people that he's appointing.
I want to ask you, if I could, Congresswoman, the same question I asked your colleague Nikki Tsongas yesterday on Radio Boston. And it's this sort of fine line that you folks have to walk. And that is, you know, we know as a candidate that Trump revealed all kinds of objectionable views about women. He talked about banning Muslims from the country, forcing them to register. Now, as you've suggested, he's appointed Stephen Bannon as a White House counselor. So how do you walk that fine line between giving Trump the kind of open mind and chance to lead that Hillary Clinton talked about without normalizing the kinds of positions that many people find so frightening?
I think we have to be vigilant on two fronts. One, we have to make sure that he honors his pledge, that he becomes a unifying president. The first way we do that is make sure that he's respecting our Constitution and our Bill of Rights for all Americans. And second, if he does that, then we evaluate his policies, proposals, legislation, people that he's filling out his cabinet with on the merits, and we take a good hard look at it and put down some markers for what we want to see to lead our country forward and to build a strong, inclusive economy.
Mm. I'd love to ask you about the future of congressional Democrats, given last week's election results. There's talk of a need for real reform, new faces, new blood to lead your caucus. Your colleague, Seth Moulton, another member of Congress from Massachusetts, led a group of more than 30 Democrats requesting to delay party leadership elections. And yesterday, Congressman Tim Ryan of Ohio said he will challenge Nancy Pelosi to become minority leader. Ryan says Democrats need to reach middle America and blue collar workers if they want to come out of the political wilderness. Here's a bit of what he said.
Well, we keep losing. I mean, I think after Tuesday, and I think going back to 2010, and didn't win enough seats in 12, lost in 14, again, didn't have a good enough year this year. I think it's just time for a change. A
couple of questions. First of all, do you agree with that, time for a change? And would you support Congressman Ryan to replace Nancy Pelosi as minority leader?
I think that we have a couple of jobs to do. One, as we go forward as a party and a caucus, we do have to analyze where we are. And I think we have to do a better job of communicating our values to the American people. And, you know, how do we do that? We now have a race for leader of the minority party, and I think that's healthy. Let's have that debate. Let's have a race. Let's have people challenge with ideas. My support, now that we know who the candidates are, remains with Nancy Pelosi because she has been a leader on the issues that matter to my constituents and matter, I think, to families across the country. At the same time, I am going to continue to push. And I have found great reception in our existing leadership that we have to bring up new members of Congress who have different ideas, that we cannot become a stale caucus, that we need to have leadership opportunities for newer members while respecting that our seniority system addressed some real existing problems with promoting people of color and women within our caucus.
Let me follow up a little bit on this idea of looking for ways to bring up younger folks, newer folks into the leadership. And, you know, the Boston Globe ran an editorial this week questioning the Democrats' ironclad seniority rule, which guarantees senior leadership posts to the longest serving members. The result is that you don't get new blood, young blood, in the party's leadership position. So is it time to change that seniority system?
I think we have to be willing to look at it and to also remember the history of where it came from. When members of Congress who were people of color, who were women, were unable to achieve leadership positions. And I think we have to understand that history, but also have the confidence to move forward that we are now in the Democratic caucus. We represent America. We have such diversity and the ability to really reflect our communities, our cities, and who we are as a country. And that is a strength.
Can I ask you just a really sort of basic existential question about how a Democratic member of Congress is thinking these days? I mean, obviously, the Republicans now control the Senate, the House, the White House. The Republicans over the last several elections have made gains in governorships and state legislatures. Massachusetts, obviously, an exception. But what's the message to Democrats who may be looking at this landscape across the country and thinking, wow, we are really on the way out here? I mean, it feels that way anyway.
I may have a different response to that than many. But if we are looking forward, I would rather bet on the Democrats in the long term than the Republicans. My basic belief is that the Democratic message is one of economic opportunity for everyone. And the way we put that in place is investing in education, investing in our infrastructure, investing in innovation and research. Those are the issues that Democrats work on and promote. And that is the vision that I don't see coming out of the Donald Trump campaign. I would be thrilled if he did a 180 change of course of direction and embrace that vision. People want a fair shot.
One more question, if I could, and this is about legislation that you're filing. You're filing a bill to ensure that the president and vice president resolve any conflicts of interest with regard to financial interests and their official responsibilities. Tell us why this legislation is necessary and what it would do.
Well, currently, federal executive branch employees, cabinet members, other high-ranking employees are prohibited from having participating in a government matter in which they or their immediate family has a financial interest. The president and vice president positions have always been exempted for that because of the complexity of the issues that they deal with. But it has become the history of modern presidents that they all have used some form of blind trust to voluntarily divest their assets. And what we're seeing in President-elect Donald Trump is a very complicated, very large business holdings. We know that there is at least one federal contract. There are loans from foreign countries, the Bank of China, Germany, but we don't have a lot of information because he never did release his tax forms. So we don't have as much information as we do about other presidents coming in. And what he is proposing is not to go the blind trust way, but to turn his businesses over to his children. And I think it is time in this day and age, especially with not only the risk of actual conflict of interest arising for President Trump, but the perceived conflict. And I think this is a common sense extension of what has become the voluntary practice of modern presidencies.
All right. Well, Congressman Catherine Clark of Massachusetts, thanks so much for joining us today. We're very grateful.
Thank you, Anthony.
And stay with us. After the break, we'll jump right into our Week in Review. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and it's Friday, so let's dive right into our Week in Review, starting with a look at the state of the Democratic Party in the wake of Donald Trump's upset victory last week. With us in the studio today, Jabari Asim, executive editor of The Crisis, the Journal of the NAACP, and a professor of creative writing at Emerson College. And Jabari, welcome back to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Tom, good to see you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's pick up with what we heard Congresswoman Catherine Clark talking about. We were talking about how Democrats are talking about leadership votes in the House. Several members of Congress, including Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, led a kind of revolt to delay the vote until after Thanksgiving. This week, Seth Moulton told WBUR that the party needs time to figure out how to respond to last week's election. Here's what he said.
If we want to move forward and have a chance of doing better in elections in the future, we've got to do some soul searching. We've got to do some listening. We've got to do some strategizing. We've got to do a lot of things differently because clearly the American people said the status quo is unacceptable.
So Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan says he wants to challenge Nancy Pelosi to become minority leader. He says Democrats keep losing and they need to reach working class folks, the kind of folks that Trump was able to appeal to during this election. Now, in the last segment, we heard Congresswoman Catherine Clark say she will support Nancy Pelosi. We heard the same thing yesterday from Congresswoman Nikki Tsongas. So, Tom, I'll start with you. What's the significance of this debate, this delay in Congress led by the likes of Seth Moulton? Is it going to take the Democrats anywhere?
I certainly like what Seth Moulton's doing here, but I'm not sure it's going to take him anywhere. Right now, it strikes me that a bomb went off a week and a half ago, and the Democrats are still in the fallout shelter and have not come out. And they're almost timid about it. They know there's something wrong. They really are flailing about trying to figure out why it is that a party that, you know, quite frankly, 10 years ago, I remember writing that demographics favored the Democratic Party in the future. But it seems like the future never becomes the present. And instead, this party has been steadily losing state houses. It's been losing the legislature. It's now lost the presidency. And it's become very much almost a regional party as opposed to a national party.
Yeah, regional, maybe a bi-regional party.
A bi-regional, right? Yeah, two regions. And you know, basically the two coasts. And that is about it. And I do think that Moulton is right that some very serious soul searching has to occur. What's distressing about the interview we just heard is I don't hear it coming from other members of Congress.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. What do you think, Jabari? What's the way forward for the Democrats here? And I mean, one of the questions I could ask, you know, is Nancy Pelosi the leader in Congress, at least for the minority, for the foreseeable future?
Well, it's interesting that, you know, Tom talked about them being timid in their reaction, because that is the long-term criticism of Democrats and liberals in general, that they're too timid to confront the issues, to confront the opposition. And it is sort of ironic that they're not signaling a new direction with the hesitant way they're sort of coming out of the box. I think the odds are very much in Pelosi's favor to hold on to her seat. But it raises interesting questions about changes that may need to take place. Moulton talked about the need to listen and to strategize. And I think there's going to have to be some emphasis on what exactly that means.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what does that? What do you think that? What does that mean, Tom?
Well, I one of the questions that you asked of Catherine Clark had been about the seniority system.
Yeah.
And she evaded really answering that question. There's no question in my mind that you need to get rid of it. The Republicans have, you know, whether you agree with them or not, the Republicans have a lot of blood that really comes up very quickly and nationalizes itself. People who just enter the party, just are elected, and all of a sudden they're in senior positions. That doesn't happen on the Democratic side.
Yeah, I think the seniority system among the Democrats, now I'm going to get this wrong, but it's something like this. The average age of the Democratic leader in the Democratic caucus is late 60s, mid 70s, somewhere in there, really, really high. So someone like Seth Moulton comes into Congress, who I really get the feeling wants to move the party in a new direction. What hope does someone like that have to sort of move up quickly in the party leadership structure?
Not right now, not much of a chance.
Yeah. So you mentioned this, Tom. Republicans now control both houses of Congress, the White House, 33 governorships, a majority of state legislatures, more than at any time in the history of the GOP. And I just came across this fact. I'm going to ask both of you guys, put you on the spot. Guess how many states have a Democratic governor and a Democratic state legislature?
Okay, I feel like I'm having an Aleppo moment here.
First, tell me how many states there are. No,
I'll tell you. There are five. Five wow. states left. Rhode Island, Connecticut, Oregon, California, and Hawaii. They're
wow.
the only five yeah. states that are still entirely controlled by Democrats. So, so I guess the final question is, why are the Democrats in the political wilderness like this? Let me ask you, Jabari.
Well, even when their message is a valid and compelling message, they seem to have they have a lot of problems in getting that to the people.
Yep.
Right. So, for example, when we say that the Democrats didn't necessarily demonstrate that they had an interest in working class concerns, you know, there are parts of the platform, there are parts of the party that very much have those concerns. But they didn't seem to do a good job conveying that. So on the national level, the presidential campaign, it did create this appearance of vulnerability in terms of being tone deaf, in terms of being distant from the concerns of working class people. I would argue that the platform and some of the advisors actually did have those things in mind, but somehow something was lost in translation between the podium and the people.
All right, last question about this, and I'll put it to you, Tom. Is it a question of message or messenger or the wrong policy?
So I think it is a question of attitude. Hmm. There is someone I think described the Democratic Party as now becoming the party of the PhDs. And there is this sense that you have an elite, maybe academically elite, that doesn't understand those who may not have the same pedigrees and kind of talks down to them. And I've heard that a lot in oftentimes the circles I travel in, which, you know, in Massachusetts, it's all Democrats. And there really is this lack of understanding about the folks on the other side. And I do think it's not only the Democratic Party, by the way, it is also the media as well, mm-hmm. and failing to understand the whole Trump phenomenon and how Trump was connecting. This is a really big problem that you have in almost two Americas, in a very different two America sense than was previously thought of, but two Americas, kind of an urban elite versus the rest of the country.
So I'm glad you brought this up, because it actually provides a perfect sort of transition to the next thing that I wanted to talk about. And this is sort of what we could call, might be called, the reddening of a blue state here in Massachusetts. Now, obviously, Massachusetts voted for Hillary Clinton, but parts of the state voted very heavily for Donald Trump. This week, the Boston Globe looked at this. It found that the same working class voters who allowed Trump to flip states in the Midwest from blue to red also turned out in Massachusetts in high numbers, and in particular in the state's western counties, where a handful of towns flipped from Democrat to Republican. I was in Fall River this week, which is still a sort of Democratic stronghold. It voted for Clinton. But at the same time, it saw a 50% increase in Republican ballots compared to the election 4 years ago. So, Jabari, are we seeing a reddening of Massachusetts, or what do you think about this?
Well, I think it's as much a matter of voting against the Democratic candidate as voting for the Republican candidate. I think we do have to acknowledge that the charisma factor, not that you could make an argument that Trump is not necessarily a charismatic figure, but there is a contrast in the way that the two candidates brought their messages to people in terms of getting a reaction of any kind. For people, even getting a strong hostile reaction in some ways is a positive thing because it's clear people have a perception of what it is you have to say. And in some of that journalism that I saw in investigating that reddening in Massachusetts, there did seem to be this sentiment that I was not excited by the Democratic candidate.
Yeah. What do you see, Tom, in this idea of the reddening of Massachusetts?
So I'm not sure I buy it as a reddening. I think it's a Trumpization.
Okay. Distinction.
And it really is, because Donald Trump is not a traditional conservative Republican. Donald Trump was bringing a message of change. He was clearly an imperfect messenger of change, but he had that very powerful message that he was against the establishment, he was against the elites, he represented the more common people. So when you see what happened in Massachusetts, you'll see that some traditionally Republican areas, like the wealthy suburbs of Boston, actually went for Hillary Clinton, while it is some very blue-collar areas that traditionally support Democrats that went for Trump. I don't think it's about the GOP. I think it's about economics.
That's interesting. Well, let's hear a little tape on this. Our WBUR's Fred Tice went to Saugus last week. It went for Obama 4 years ago, this year for Trump. Fred talked to one voter, Steve Petkovich, who explained why he voted for Trump. Here's what he said.
We're overpopulated. You keep letting people in this country, you got to draw the line somewhere. It's not even the Latinos. I mean, they're hard workers. You just can't let people into this country without going through the legal system or, you know, doing it the right way. It's not fair to the people that did it the right way. All he wants to do is get rid of the criminals. He doesn't want to send people back that have kids here. That's not going to happen.
So there's a voter in Saugus, Steve Petkovich, talking about one of the reasons why he voted for Donald Trump, this fear over illegal immigration. Jabari, what did you hear in that?
Well, one thing I was curious, he said it's not the Latinos. Then I wondered who exactly this targeted other was that he was responding to. I'd like to see some clarification there. That was particularly confusing. And it reminds me of the comedian Dave Chappelle saying, you know, we're talking as if we want to pick our own strawberries, some of these people. People, right? And so, you know, the manufacturing jobs aren't coming back. We've converted to a service economy, if that. And it's hard to see how even Trump has articulated the role that let's say, reforming trade policy would play in actually bringing manufacturing back to the Rust Belt.
Yeah. Interesting. Tom?
So it was interesting to hear that. It's the illegals that bother him. Well, there's a really simple solution to that, of course. Reform the immigration laws to make it easier to come into this country legally. But that's not what people want here. This is not about the so-called illegals. This is about immigrants coming in who really don't look like the rest of America.
I want to ask what you think Trump's victory means for our Republican governor, Charlie Baker. Baker did not support Trump, and he said that he left the presidential ballot blank. The reason I want to ask this, I've spoken to a few hardcore Trump supporters in this state who say they're angry at Baker for this. And I'm just wondering if this puts him in a tough spot with part of the Republican base. What do you think, Tom?
So I think it does put him in a tough part with part of the Republican base, but I don't think he's going to end up facing a very serious primary challenge. I think any challenge he faces a couple of years from now, he's going to be able to meet that challenge, and he'll be the nominee again if he wants, in fact, to run again. I do think it's going to be interesting to see how Massachusetts relates to the White House. There might be a good sign there in terms of what might be going on this weekend with Trump meeting with Romney. And perhaps you'll just see that bridges can be mended despite out of Romney, the harshest rhetoric we ever heard against Trump. So maybe Charlie Baker has a chance in sort of that patching up as well.
I want to talk about the Romney thing a little bit later, but let's stick with this idea about what a Trump presidency might mean to Massachusetts. So this week, Charlie Baker was asked about Trump's campaign pledge to defund sanctuary cities, which include Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, among others, and basically a sanctuary city. A loose definition, I guess, is a city that doesn't cooperate with federal efforts to identify or deport undocumented immigrants. Here's what Baker said.
We're a global community. We're a global commonwealth. People need to feel welcome here. And I can tell you point blank as governor that I will continue to work with my colleagues in state and local government and with others to ensure that everybody feels welcome here in the Commonwealth of Mass. And we will not tolerate acts of violence against anyone.
Jabari, is Baker in a tough spot here, or what's your view about this idea that Tom brought up, his relationship with a Trump administration?
Well, two things. Trump is punitive and petty. So on the executive level, he's probably is going to run into some problems. But in terms of speaking out against Trump's policy towards sanctuary cities, Baker's going to be part of a company of like-minded public officials that are already making those kind of comments. Mm-hmm. For example, the nation's largest police union endorsed Trump, but police chiefs around the country are already saying, we're not going to cooperate with that particular policy. So I think there Baker won't be alone and there'll be strength in numbers.
I'm really curious about this, finally, before we leave the sort of Charlie Baker question. He represents a kind of disappearing breed of moderate Northeastern Republicans. Does this sort of brand of moderate Baker-style Republicanism have a future in the land of Trump? We'll start with you. I mean, in the age of Trump, Tom Keene?
So prior to the most recent election cycle, everyone thought that there really could be a resurgence. That was the whole GOP rethinking after Romney's loss to Obama, that you really needed to reach out and start to appeal to new demographic groups. I think that rethinking is on the table at this point, and no one's going to be paying attention to it. I think that the message out of Trump's election for a lot of people is going to be that you need to appeal to people the way that Trump appealed to people, and that will not be the way Charlie Baker, very admirably in that clip, was really reaching out to the dispossessed and saying that he's going to treat them fairly. That's not going to be the Republican Party we're going to hear across the nation.
Do you agree with that, Jabari?
Yeah, I think it comes down to image management. You know, for example, you know, we're talking about how the Democrats come off as, say, professorial, when at the elite level, the Republicans are equally professorial, if we can be generous and call Newt Gingrich a former professor. So we have that degree of educated elite, but somehow they come off differently, despite having very similar backgrounds.
I'd love to talk briefly with you guys about the future Trump administration and how it's taking shape. We learned today that he's picked Lieutenant General Michael Flynn as National Security Advisor, Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions as Attorney General, and Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo as CIA Director. So let's start with Sessions. Here he is back in February when he endorsed Donald Trump at a rally in Huntsville, Alabama.
You have asked for 30 years, and politicians have promised for 30 years to fix illegal immigration. Have they done it?
No.
Donald Trump will do it.
Yeah.
All right, so that's Jeff Sessions, announced today to be Donald Trump's choice as Attorney General. We should note that in 1986, a Senate committee denied Sessions a federal judgeship because former colleagues testified that he used the N-word and joked about the KKK. Let me start with that. Thoughts about Sessions or all three of these folks about what it says about the coming Trump administration, Jabari?
Well, I'm going to echo Catherine Clark. He said he was going to unite the whole country, but these four appointments do anything but. I know in the African-American community, Bannon and Sessions in particular are repugnant choices. It's hard to imagine a worse choice than Jeff Sessions. So I think we're still looking for that conciliatory gesture around the country. We're not seeing it so far.
Yeah, what are you seeing, Tom, in these early days?
So right after the election, a lot of people kind of viewed Donald Trump like an inkblot, you know, looking at him and trying to figure out, well, is he a pragmatist? Could he really be a liberal in conservative clothes? Could he be conservative? What's he really going to be all about? I think these three picks right here are very hardcore conservative picks, and they're at least telling us that at this moment Donald Trump is going after and trying to shore up his conservative base. And that's absolutely what these folks are. I actually think they'll end up getting approved by the Senate. Sessions has made a lot of friends in the 30 years since and probably is actually pretty well liked within the Senate. What will be interesting to see with Trump is whether this is it and then he starts going to more moderate figures for his other cabinet appointments. And that might be a possibility. I mean, I do think Trump's going to be all over the place. Mm-hmm. And he is going to – you'll be able to read into him what you want to read into him. But certainly at this point, he's conservative.
Yeah, and in that regard, you brought up the name Mitt Romney, former Massachusetts governor. He's going to be meeting with Donald Trump this weekend. There's talk that he might be under consideration for Secretary of State. This just makes my head spin, because don't forget, Mitt Romney's the guy who called Donald Trump a phony, a fraud. Donald Trump referred to him as you know, one of the biggest losers for losing the last election. What do you think about this, Jabari? And I mean, what's the significance of Mitt Romney meeting with Donald Trump, and do you think he could end up with a cabinet position?
Yeah, I think it's sort of like what Tom said. It's a gesture toward the center, if we can cut it with. Yeah. If we're looking at a sliding scale, then Romney is centrist compared to some of these people. And it also kind of borrows from the whole team of rivals concept, right? That I can be so presidential and such a chief executive that I can entertain opposing opinions from different people who advise me. So I think part of that idea is also animating these gestures.
Yeah. What do you think about the Mitt Romney thing, Tom?
Well, of course, it's reminiscent of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, right, where they ran against each other, sometimes very harsh rhetoric back and forth, and yet Barack Obama names Hillary Clinton Secretary of State. The rumor out there is that Romney will be up for Secretary of State as well, which I think actually would be a terrific move if that actually happens.
Would that sort of signal that so Trump can sort of go both ways, hardcore conservative, but he's also prepared to be
right.
a little more moderate? Yeah.
Right. I mean, the thing about Donald Trump, it's always struck me, is that the man is unprincipled. And I mean that in the sense that there are no hard driving ideological principles behind what he does. He is a pragmatist who figured out how to get elected. And right now, he's figuring out he needs to sop to his conservative base. But he's also, I think, going to all be reaching out and having to pull other people into his orbit because he wants to be able to effectively govern. And you can't effectively govern with such a narrow margin as he has right now.
Mm. All right. Well, we've got just enough time left here for our hubbubs, those brief stories that caught our attention, maybe fell below the fold, didn't make the front page. Jabari, let me start with you. What's your hubbub this week?
It's the National Book Awards. I mean, part of it is, you know, I'm partial to books, and I remember all the attention the Oscars got when the winners and the nominees weren't particularly diverse. National Book Awards does a much better job, and the winners were a very diverse lot, and I would like to have seen more attention directed to that.
So, Well, then enlighten us. Give us one or two of the picks that excited you.
Colson Whitehead won for fiction for The Underground Railroad. Ibrahim Kendi won for Stamped from the Beginning for nonfiction. And Congressman John Lewis also won for the best book for young readers. So, you know, it's a pretty diverse bunch indicative of other places in popular culture. You know, movies could be that diverse. Plays could be that diverse. I think that books are setting the example, and I'd like to see publishing, at least the awards part of publishing, get more of a pat on the back for that.
All right. Tom, yeah. Your hubba.
So there was another election this week, one that was also filled with controversy, one that pitted the East Coast against the Midwest, one that was beset with charges of fraud and vote rigging. I refer, of course, to the selection of Red Sox pitcher Rick Porcello for the American League Cy Young Award. Detroit's Justin Verlander actually received more first-place votes than did Porcello, but shades of the Electoral College. The rules of the Baseball Writers Association of America are complicated, and lo and behold, Porcello ended up the winner. Midwesterners are furious. New Englanders, of course, are delighted. This particular election got me thinking about why we so love sports. People argue, tempers flare, sides are taken, passions run deep. Everyone's a critic, everyone has an opinion, and the battles can almost seem like death matches. But at the end of the day, and unlike a certain other election, people aren't deported, no one loses their human rights, and the earth itself is not imperiled. That's the beauty of sports and why we embrace it. It's got all of the mishigas without any of the consequences.
All right, well said. So my hubbub is related to sports as well, and it's that finally, at long last, we get to hear Patriot quarterback Tom Brady sound off and express his frustration about Deflategate, the overblown, so to speak, scandal about underinflated footballs that led to a four-game suspension, which is another term for a vacation on the Riviera for Tom Brady. So it comes in a new commercial for the Foot Locker, specifically for the Foot Locker's so-called Week of Greatness, in which a pair of teens question how Foot Locker has managed to sustain its success for so long. Brady overhears their doubts and sounds off. Here's what he says.
Kind of makes you wonder what Foot Locker's up to.
You know, that's an unfortunate mindset you got there.
Tom Brady.
Just because something's great year after year doesn't mean anything's going on. Why can't some things just be great?
Just a question.
It starts with questions, and then questions turn into assumptions, and then assumptions turn into vacations. So why would you punish the Week of Greatness for something that never even happened? I lost my appetite.
So there's Tom Brady.
That's great.
You know, I think he's on his way to an acting career after his football career ends.
Another
10 years from now. But Jabari Yassim, executive editor of The Crisis and the Journal for the NAACP and a professor of creative writing at Emerson College, thanks for coming in. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
And Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor. He's a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Tom, thank you as well.
It was a pleasure.
Stay with us, listeners. Coming up, new music and reflection from Mehmet Ali Sanlikal and his jazz ensemble, What's Next? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is music from Mehmet Ali Sanlikal and his ensemble What's Next from their new album Resolution. Sanlikal is a Boston-based Turkish-born American composer. Through his music, he expresses the many cultural identities of Islam. Identities, he says, that are now more than ever being forgotten. This song is the Turkish Second Line, featuring clarinetist Anat Cohen. Mehmet Ali Sanlikal is a faculty member at the New England Conservatory and Emerson College and a fellow at Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Study. And he joins us now in the studio. And Mehmet, welcome back to Radio Boston. I always look forward to talking to you. I'm glad you came in today.
Thank you, Anthony. It's great to be here.
Yeah, and congratulations about this music, which we're hearing right under us. So tell us a little bit about this particular piece, the Turkish Second Line, from your new album, Resolution.
Sure. I had this idea of taking the well-known Middle Eastern Çiftetelli dance pattern and combining it with the New Orleans second line brass beats. And, you know, I heard it in my head and I thought that, well, why don't I write a big band piece that, combines these two musical patterns and feels and, more importantly, cultures. And, however, bring in a clarinetist that can hopefully speak to both worlds, that is the Middle East as well as the American. And so I contacted Anat Cohen, and as a result, we have the Turkish Second Line.
Well, let's just listen to a little bit more. Tim, let's just bring it up a little bit. Great sound. You know, Mehmet, I've always, what I love about what you do are these connections that you draw between American jazz and music from your native Turkey and that part of the world. And this seems like another great exploration of that.
Absolutely. That is one of the things that I always try to do. I look for meeting points, melting points. And as a musician who studied for extended amount of years, both jazz and classical composition, but also I devoted about a decade to studying Ottoman, Turkish, Greek classical musics. And at the end of this period, at around 2012, I finally started being able to hear how these musics can merge in internalized ways and not necessarily commercialized ways.
So what do you mean by that? Because the question I was going to ask, can you sort of explain the connections between American jazz and music from that part of the world?
Well, let me point out one thing. Yeah. There are more connections between the former Ottoman geography and America than one may think. May I begin with the Zildjians? Okay, if people know...
They make cymbals.
They make cymbals.
Right here in the Boston area, right?
Well, they used to be... they got their start back in 1600s in Constantinople, what is now Istanbul.
You mean they predate Boston, yes. Okay, good.
Well, you know, and so there are others. The founders of Atlantic Records, yeah. Ahmet Ertegün.
That's right.
You know, the Turkish people.
Who brought us Ray Charles,
exactly.
Among others.
Exactly. Yeah. Arif Mardin, multiple Grammy-winning producer, you know. He was, you know, and then Dave Brubeck gave us Take Five. Mm. You know how he gave that to us? He went to Istanbul and discovered people improvising in odd meters. And he decided he's going to compose jazz and improvise in odd meters.
Mehmet, we're going to talk more about music, and I want to play more music from your new CD, Resolution. But I want to talk to you a little bit about a subject that I know you've been thinking about, and you sort of approached us about this, and it just seems important to bring this up.
Yes.
You're thinking hard about the current political situation in America, and what Donald Trump has said about Muslim immigration, about Muslims in general. One of the ways I suppose we could identify you is a Muslim American. How are you thinking about what's going on out there?
Well, the more obvious thing is that, of course, this divisive approach I don't think is helping. But there's another layer to this, which I have been realizing more recently, and maybe that is not all that apparent to people. It's interesting to me, while there are attacks on Islam or Muslims overall, there seems to be a cartoon image, a stereotyped image of the Muslim that is emerging. Because while trying to defend Muslims, there is this cartoonish image where an oppressed Muslim emerges. You know, it's the kind that is conservative, the kind, you know, where the women are veiled and the men, you know, or the communities praying five times a day and so on and so forth. Well, I have great amount of respect to Muslims who do adhere to those kinds of obligatory practices. But then again, the many worlds of Islam, and this is what I'm really looking to put out there. There is Sufism, that is the spiritual side of Islam. There is a lot of people very much looking to claim the Muslim identity, but they're secular. Mm. I mean, there are millions of people.
So this stereotype that's being perpetuated sort of overlooks the secular Muslim tradition, for example.
Of course. I mean, and the culture of Islam in general. Yeah. It's almost like boiling it all down to the mosque.
Mm.
That doesn't make sense. In fact, it's very unfair. And number one, it excludes millions of people, including myself. Number two, it actually, in my opinion, helps this divisive rhetoric out there. Because how are people that are already not knowledgeable about Islam are to gain consciousness? You know, there's only one chance that people have. And that is only if they gain consciousness about the kind of spread that exists in the many worlds of Islam, just like it does exist in among the Christians, among Jews, among Buddhists, among whatever religion or faith system you may think about.
Mm. You know, you're a musician, a composer, a jazz player. You're also a teacher at the New England Conservatory and Emerson College. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you have what the conversations are like among students around this very issue?
Well, even prior to the election, I was sensing discomfort. And you can only imagine, as a teacher, you know, I am to lecture every semester once at least about music in Islam. That's just a part of my most of my world music courses. There is just a segment that where I cover this area. Whenever I am to speak about it, there is this thing that is in the air. It makes me uncomfortable because I'm feeling, well, I'm a Muslim. Well, how about if these kids are they ready? What are they going to think? You know, and so it was there even prior to the election. Maybe now I feel, in fact, more comforted because I feel that there is a cause for me to now raise my voice more about this.
Yeah.
You know, but Sufism is the thing that I also want to really bring out there. It has taken...
So say more about that and maybe start with a sort of a kind of baseline definition by it, because I'm sure a lot of folks don't know a whole lot about Sufism.
Sure. I mean, the simplest of all definitions is that it is Islamic mysticism.
Yeah.
But a lot of people may have heard about the whirling dervishes and so on and so forth, these dervish brotherhoods who have more recently in Islamic worlds have been more in the background. They've actually led the culture, many artistic culture of Islam for many decades and centuries and so on and so forth. In fact, it was these dervishes that have endorsed arts, music, calligraphy, poetry, and so on and so forth in the greater history of Islam. One we can point out is Rumi, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Rumi, who is buried in central Turkey on the other side of this planet, happens to be the best-selling poet in the United States during the past decade or so. So it's not even irrelevant for me to bring this up. It is very relevant in an American context too. But I say Sufism is important because Muslims like me particularly, we draw from that well. It's a treasure. It's, you know, it is the soul of Islam. The spiritual ballet of the whirling dervishes is the kind of thing that needs to be known more about.
I'm so glad you brought this up. So with that, let's listen to a little bit more music from your new album, Resolution. This is, I'm going to probably pronounce this wrong, a jazzed up Devri Revan.
Actually, perfect.
I did that perfectly. Okay, let's listen to a little bit of this. So that's a jazzed up Devri Revan. We're going to let it play a little bit underneath us. Mehmet Ali Sanlikal's new album, Resolution. So tell us about this piece and what you're hoping to evoke with it.
Well, first of all, the piece itself is modeled after the rituals of the whirling dervishes.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of Sufism.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
Speaking of Sufism, here we are. And I ended up composing the piece, but also playing the spiritual emblem of the Mevlevi dervishes, the Ney flute, on top of the jazz orchestra, and I, you know, found ways to make that work. But it is a piece that is deeply rooted in classical Turkish music and a kind of Sufi identity.
Let's bring it up again. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's great.
Thank you.
It's great. So where does this... Say more about the sort of poetic inspirations of Sufism. Where does it take you? In terms of poetry and in terms of the music as well.
Let me put this in perspective for people listening. When I came here to Boston 23 years ago, I didn't know anything about Turkish music or Middle Eastern music. My mother is a classical piano teacher, so I grew up more with Chopin and Beethoven and Mozart. And I was at some point I discovered Charlie Parker, and I was here to study that, and I did. But eventually, when I discovered Sufism, when I discovered my roots from a different perspective, it changed my life.
Hmm.
It has that potential for anyone, really. it's it is a spiritual awakening. You know, for John Coltrane, it was a love supreme. For me, it is this kind of Sufi music. And of course, one other thing, not all Sufism is alike. It's a huge universe. But I tend to identify with the Mevlevi and the Bektashi dervishes, and their poetry and music really uplifts me and gives me the inspiration to realize these musical experiments and compositions.
Well, Mehmet, I can't think of a better way to end a week that has been all about the hard edges of politics with the soft and giving and beautiful exploration of music and culture from Charlie Parker to Sufism and beyond. Thank you for bringing this wonderful soup to us.
It is my absolute pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me and giving my voice to me, a chance to be heard.
So Mehmet Ali Samlokal is a professor at the New England Conservatory, Emerson College, and a fellow at Harvard Center for Middle Eastern Study. His new album with the jazz orchestra What's Next is called Resolution, and we'll go out today with another song from that album entitled Whirl Around. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.